So the quantum mechanics of global warming. Global warming, or climate change more properly, is the most interdisciplinary science we can really imagine. It involves all of these fields of the so-called hard sciences: applied math, astronomy, biology, chemistry, geology, meteorology, oceanography, physics. And input from physics comes through basic equations and simple estimates, which will be the main thrust of this talk, but also it enables us to construct rather complicated models, actually perhaps the most complicated models that have ever been constructed, of the Earth's climate. So it's truly a multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary field, and it's impossible for any one person to master all of these areas. Probably at this point it's impossible to master any one of these areas. So I'll be giving you a very particular perspective from the standpoint of physics, of climate change. So since we're physicists here, let's begin by looking at the basic time scales of the problem and also the basic spatial scales. This is a cartoon of the important time scales of the climate problem, starting from an age of order, the age of the Earth, 4.6 billion years, and going down to fractions of years. And on the vertical axis is some indication of the relative importance of some of these processes. So you could think of it as some sort of crude power spectrum, but I emphasize this is just a cartoon sketch. We'll be seeing some real power spectra later. So at the very longest time scales, we have the problem that the sun was probably considerably cooler back then, according to theories of stellar evolution, and yet the Earth supported liquid water. At timescales of hundreds of millions of years, we have the phenomenon of continental drift, like the breakup of a supercontinent, which certainly had an influence on the Earth's climate. Over tens of millions of years, we have mountain building, or orogeny. So the uplift of the Himalaya plateau almost certainly had a profound effect on the Earth's climate. And then at these shorter timescales of tens of thousands of years, you see three peaks here, and they have a very interesting origin, which I'll come back to in the middle of the talk. On the human timescales, we have the so-called climate optimum. Several thousand years ago was particularly favorable for the development of agriculture, and so the four great civilizations began at that point. We have fluctuations on the timescales of hundreds of years, the Little Ice Age. And then you see these very sharp spectral features at 1 year and 6 months in its harmonics. And that's simply the annual or the seasonal cycle of the Earth going around the sun. And then, of course, at 1 day in its harmonics, we have the diurnal day-night cycle. Over periods of a few days, we have so-called synoptic disturbances. These are just the weather fronts that pass through at the mid-latitudes. And then at shorter timescales, we have turbulence and other phenomena. So a vast range of timescales and also a vast range of spatial scales, making this a very challenging problem. All right, so the outline of my talk is I'm going to be giving you three examples where quantum mechanics plays an important role in our understanding of climate change. And the first really is at the origins, historical origins of quantum mechanics, and that is the Planck black body spectrum. And that's going to allow us to make the simplest possible estimate of the Earth's temperature. That'll lead us to the question of why aren't we freezing? And we're going to invoke quantum mechanics again to understand why we aren't. And then the third example is comes from deciphering ice and sediment cores reaching back several millions of years, trying to deduce the temperature in the past. Then I'll talk about the historic past and extrapolate 100 years into this century. And then I'll really push things and talk about a little bit of research I'm doing, which I'll just tentatively call quantum field theory of global warming. It sounds crazy, but hold on, and I think you'll see what I mean. And there's no symmetry. And then, if I have time, but I probably won't, I might have some comments on the politics of climate change, which is a rather dismal subject in recent years. All right, so let's begin with Planck's blackbody radiation. Turns out that the sun is very nearly a perfect blackbody radiator. And so if we use a sophisticated spectrometer, such as a CD disk, and shine sunlight or light from an incandescent light on it, of course, we get a nice continuous spectrum. And just from the simple observation that this spectrum, the intensity at any given wavelength is a function both of the temperature of the source and the frequency or the wavelength that we're looking at. For example, if we were shining light from a cooler source, we would only get a dull red glow. Just from that simple observation, we can do some dimensional analysis in the spirit of 19th century classical physics. So we write the intensity is some function of temperature and frequency. And then knowing that intensity is in the units of watts per meter squared or joules per meter squared per second. And temperature, if we're a 19th century physicist, we can convert to energy by multiplying by Boltzmann's constant. And frequency, of course, has the units of 1 over time. Invoking the known physical constants from the 19th century, the speed of light and Boltzmann's constant, we can write down the dimensionally correct expression for the intensity of light at a given frequency as a function of temperature. So we have kBT, which is just gives us the joules. Then we divide by C squared, that gives us the joules per meter squared. We get an extra second squared, which we cancel out with the nu squared up here, and then we need 1 over seconds to get the units of intensity. And of course, we could have reasoned this also from the equipartition theorem by giving each mode an energy of order kBT, and then we have nu squared modes in an interval delta nu. And of course, this has the famous problem of the ultraviolet divergence. When we sum up the contribution from all of those frequencies, we get infinity because of this nu squared. And that was the origin of the crisis in 19th century physics that Max Planck solved by introducing a new constant of nature, H. And now, of course, with the idea that light is made up of particles called photons that carry energy. And that allows us to write down the correct expression for the intensity, which in the limit of low frequencies reduces to our classical expression, which makes sense since there's going to be a large number of photons in each mode in that limit, so it's going to be classical. But of course, in the high frequency limit, this exponential cuts off the intensity. And so we can do that sum over the frequencies, and we have the famous Stefan-Boltzmann law that the intensity is proportional to the temperature to the fourth power. And that's actually all we need to know for our simplest estimate of the Earth's temperature. We don't even need to know this constant because it's going to drop out. But before we do that, let's just look at one of the best tests of this law, which comes from the COBE microwave satellite. And so this looks like a theoretical plot, but it's actually an experimental measurement of the microwave background radiation left over from the Big Bang. And the theoretical result lies underneath this line, and the line's thickness actually doesn't do justice to the degree of agreement, which is better than one part in 100,000. So a fantastic agreement with Planck's original theory. So now let's apply this to the simplest possible calculation of the temperature of the Earth. So we'll just assume that the Earth is in a thermal steady state. It receives as much energy from the sun as it re-radiates back out into space. So we need to do a little bit of geometry. Well, first of all, let's note that some of the light that is striking the Earth is not absorbed but immediately reflected back out into space. That's why, of course, we can see these clouds as bright surfaces. But apart from that fudge factor, the fraction of the solar intensity that's absorbed by the Earth is going to be equal to the area that the Earth presents to the sun. The Earth looks like a disk from the point of view of the sun, so it has an area of pi times its radius squared. And then if we encapsulate the sun in a giant sphere with the radius of the Earth's orbit, that has an area of 4 pi times the radius of the Earth's orbit squared. So this ratio is the amount of the solar flux that the Earth intercepts, and then we correct by this factor, accounting for the light going back out into space. So now let's balance the energy flux. So the luminosity of the sun is going to be equal to its surface area times sigma t to the fourth. And if we look at the portion that's going to be absorbed by the Earth, here's that geometric factor. And the albedo, the correction due to the reflection back out into space. And we're going to equate that to the black body radiation that the Earth itself emits back out into space at its own much lower temperature. And now we need to multiply by the entire area of the Earth, because we're going to assume the Earth is characterized by one single temperature, both the nighttime and daytime sides, which is a pretty good approximation. All right, well, so if we do the algebra, Stefan-Boltzmann constant cancels out as well as a number of other factors. We plug in the numbers, then we arrive at our simplest possible estimate, which only depends weakly on the albedo, and it's about minus 20 degrees Celsius. So according to this simplest possible calculation, we would say, well, the Earth should be freezing. So what's wrong with that? Well, of course, the thing that's wrong with that is that we've neglected the influence of the atmosphere. Now, the atmosphere does many things. One is actually good from the standpoint of our crudest calculation, because what it does is it transports heat from the equatorial regions up to the polar regions, so it works to keep the Earth at a more uniform temperature than it would be if it had no atmosphere. So that's in congruence with our assumption. But of course, the other thing it does is it acts to trap the outgoing infrared radiation. So we need to account for that. But before we do that, let's just see how well our simple formula works for the nearest planets. So here's Earth, which we just worked out. Let's look at Venus. Venus is, of course, closer to the sun than the Earth. But because it's completely covered with clouds, it reflects 3/4 of the light hitting it and only absorbs 1/4. So its radiative temperature, that is the temperature from our black body formula, is actually lower than that of the Earth. On the other hand, its surface temperature, of course, is much higher, over 400 degrees Celsius. And that, of course, is because the atmosphere of Venus is extremely thick. It has atmospheric pressure. The pressure at the bottom is about 90 Earth atmospheres, and it's mainly carbon dioxide with some sulfuric acid clouds. On the other hand, if we look at Mars, Mars, of course, is farther from the sun than the Earth. It reflects a little bit less of the light. But its radiative temperature, is quite small, minus 56 degrees Celsius, but that's actually in quite good agreement with its mean surface temperature of minus 53 degrees Celsius. So the difference between these numbers is only 3 degrees Celsius. That's what I'll call the greenhouse warming. That's the part that can be attributed to the atmosphere. And of course, Mars has a very thin atmosphere, so the fact that our formula works for Mars is understandable.
We intrinsically assume that the Earth radiates back out to space as a black body with no emissivity factor.
That's right, yeah. So I made a simple, you know, the simplest possible calculation for the Earth. I mean, that's what the atmosphere is going to affect. So it turns out the oceans are very close to a black body, but there certainly are corrections, yeah. And a more refined model would have to take into account those.
With that refined model, you're not very far off in calculating an effective temperature of minus 15 C or minus 18 C versus mean temperature 15 C.
Right.
It's not that much of a correction.
Right, but we'll now attempt to make that correction. So, well, let's repeat our little experiment with spectra and now replace the sun or our incandescent light with a fluorescent light and have a little gap there, shine that on our CD, and of course we now have a nice set of spectral lines from the mercury and other gases in the fluorescent tube. So in the case of the atmosphere, water is a polar molecule, and so it has a dipole moment and therefore absorbs strongly in the infrared, the infrared vibrational modes and rotational modes are quantized at various energies, and so the photons that can be absorbed or emitted are specified by Planck's formula. Likewise, carbon dioxide, even though it doesn't have a dipole moment in the ground state, does have an oscillating dipole moment when it's in the excited state, so it has a strong cross-section for absorbing infrared photons and emitting them again. The main constituent gases of the atmosphere, nitrogen, oxygen, and argon, on the other hand, have no dipole moment and also don't have any dipole moment even when they're oscillating. So Svante Arrhenius, over 100 years ago, pointed out the role of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in maintaining the temperature on the ground. Back then, carbon dioxide was called carbonic acid. And in this influential paper, he carried out the first real calculation of the role of carbon dioxide. And so if we just look at a modified energy flux diagram, here's our incoming solar radiation. This is 1/4 of the solar constant due to that geometric factor of pi over 4 pi. And as I said, some of it's reflected off of the clouds in the atmosphere, some is reflected off the surface, some is absorbed in the surface, and then it's re-radiated at a much longer wavelength, some going straight out to space, some being intercepted by clouds or greenhouse gases and being redirected back down. Also, we have other processes such as convection or evaporation, which lifts thermal latent heat up into the atmosphere where it is released when water vapor condenses. Now, I used to think Arrhenius was the first to realize that carbon dioxide played an important role, but actually a Irish scientist named John Tyndall, I believe, is the first to really understand this. And he said in 1861, researches on glaciers directed my attention in a special manner to the observations and speculations on the transmission of solar and terrestrial heat through the Earth's atmosphere. And he actually carried out some experiments of the thermal properties of gases. Here's his setup. He has a tube that he would fill with carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide, different gases. And here is a differential thermocouple. So he's conducting a kind of null experiment. He has some water here that has a thermometer. It's being heated by a Bunsen burner and some screens. And he's going to null out the infrared flux coming from this source versus another source over here, which must shine through this tube containing the gas in question. So he actually conducted, I think, the first measurements of the infrared optical properties of gases. So here's the actual property of the measured property of the Earth's atmosphere. This is a black body spectrum for the sun, and for the Earth, this is a function of wavelength. So this is submicrons. This is the optical range, and this is the infrared range. And you can see that at the ground level, the Earth's atmosphere is largely absorbing, except in this window in the optical region, which is, of course, why we can see the sun. But then there are these distinct bands that can be associated with the constituent gases of water, carbon dioxide, and so on. Now, notice that these bands are quite broad. That's of crucial importance to all this, because if the atmosphere had been very thin, the bands would be very narrow, and then they would not absorb much of this continuum spectrum. So the most important greenhouse gas is water vapor, and the secondary importance, carbon dioxide and methane here, and also chlorofluorocarbons and various other gases. And as I said, the absorption lines are pressure broadened. And when we take into account those lines, then our black body temperature, radiative temperature, is increased by around 30 degrees, bringing us something close to the actual mean temperature of the Earth, which is around 15 degrees Celsius. So let's see how that works. So this is a very simple model that comes from a nice book by John Hart, who's a theoretical physicist turned ecologist. He's at Berkeley. It's called Consider a Spherical Cow. I recommend it to you. He recently wrote a sequel to this, which is a slightly better approximation on reality, called Consider a Cylindrical Cow. It's very nice. All right, so here's our simple model. We're going to dress up that simple black body calculation by now assuming that the atmosphere can be treated as two layers. So the two layers come from simply looking at that empirical absorption that we just saw, the idea that a photon on average will be absorbed and re-emitted twice on its way back out into space. So here's our incoming flux, and then as before, some of it is reflected back out into space. Now, this layer here, this lower layer of the atmosphere, is emitting at some temperature T1, so it emits flux both downwards and upwards. The upwards flux is absorbed by the upper layer, and it has some lower temperature, T0, and it also is emitting. So there's some infrared flux here going out into space because this is the upper layer. Then we have evaporation and so on. So this is a semi-empirical model where we're going to balance the energy fluxes leaving the surface, leaving this first lower layer of the atmosphere and the second layer of the atmosphere, assuming steady state. And we'll just put in the empirical numbers for some of these other processes, such as convective heat transfer and infrared flux going straight out into space, for example, going through one of those windows in the atmosphere absorption spectrum. And if we plug in the numbers, then we get actually a temperature on the surface of 16 degrees Celsius, which is within 1 degree or so of the actual value. So it's really remarkable that we get such excellent agreement for such a simple model. Of course, there is some empirical input, but I think that this is a fair test for such a model. Okay, so now let's turn to a third example of quantum mechanics, which comes from deciphering the climate over the past several million years now. So this is a famous plot of coming from the Vostok ice core in Antarctica from a combined French-Russian team. And what they looked at, they drilled a core down through the ice in the center of Antarctica, and they extracted information about the temperature of the Earth and also the carbon dioxide content over the past 160,000 years. So how did they do this? Well, the ice core, at least near the top, shows annual deposition layers, so one can date it year by year, and you can extrapolate down at deeper levels. And there are little bubbles of air trapped in this ice core, which can be extracted, and the carbon dioxide concentration can be measured. The temperature can also be deduced, and let me hold off on explaining how that is. That's actually the third example of quantum mechanics. Let's just look at the results here first. So this is the present warm period. This is the last ice age, and a previous warm period or interglacial, and a previous ice age before that. Carbon dioxide, you can see, seems to go roughly like the temperature, but from this plot, it's not possible to deduce causality because the temporal resolution is not good enough. And furthermore, it could be just a coincidence, perhaps, that these two things seem to be in agreement. Well, let's look at the carbon dioxide concentration. You can see over the past 160,000 years, it hasn't exceeded about 280 parts per million by volume. Does anyone know what the current concentration in the atmosphere is? Not 340, was 340. Now it's about 370 parts per million. So the current concentration is greater, as I'll show you in a moment, than it has been in the past half a million years, probably greater than it's been in the past 20 million years, as far as can be told. So the current concentration's up here. So just apart from anything else, this would give you some pause that there's something to worry about. Now, as far as this correlation being spurious, well, the experiment has recently been completed. The ice core has been drilled as deep as it will go. Here it is. It's limited by the fact that it's actually reaching the bottom of the ice sheet where it's going to break through to a lake called Lake Vostok, which they didn't want to contaminate with bacteria from the surface. And here's the result. Up here is the carbon dioxide concentration. This is what we were just looking at, now going back 420,000 years. And you can clearly see this sequence of low and high levels. Below it is the temperature. This is the present warm period, last ice age, previous interglacial, last ice age before that, interglacial ice age, interglacial ice age. The correlation seems to hold up. And as you can see, the carbon dioxide concentration, as I said, hasn't really exceeded about 280 parts per million over this 420,000 year time frame. Now notice that the timing of these ice ages seems to be rather regular, about every 100,000 years, and we'll need to explain that. I'll try to do that in a moment. But before we do that, let's look at the origin, or how it's possible that people were able to deduce the temperature of the Earth from looking at this ice. And the reason for this, the main reason, is actually, rather surprisingly, quantum zero-point motion. So how does that play a role? Classically, of course, we know that all motion ceases at absolute zero temperature and everything would freeze into a solid. But quantum mechanically, we know that that's not quite true. There's still some motion in some sense at zero temperature, and this is why liquid helium never freezes, at least at room pressure. So a simple model of this, we can think of some helium atoms with some harmonic potential between them, spring and mass model. And so there's going to be some frequency of vibration, and there'll be some zero point energy associated for that mode of oscillation of 1/2 h nu. So small mass means a relatively large quantum zero-point motion. And in the case of helium, that's enough to overcome the tendency to crystallize. In the case of water trapped in the ice, it's a quantitative effect, not a qualitative effect. It turns out that about 0.2% of water contains the heavier isotope of oxygen, O18, with two extra neutrons. So classically, both of these molecules have the same energy. But the quantum point motion means that the water that contains the heavier isotope of oxygen has a little bit less energy and is a little bit less likely, therefore, to evaporate during cold spells. So technically, its vapor pressure is a little bit less. And that's how the temperature can have an influence on the isotopic concentration. So what was really plotted in those plots reconstructing the temperature was the deviation in the O18 concentration from some standard value. Now, the details of this physics are a bit more complicated than what I've described here. One has to take into account the quantization of the excited modes and so on. But the zero-point motion is probably the most important effect. In any case, empirically, this relationship can be tested. This is looking at present-day data at different locations in Greenland. And you can see that the delta O18 concentration is linearly related to the temperature, the average temperature at the location which this ice was retrieved. So it's a very beautiful linear relationship. And we could have done a simple back of the envelope calculation. It would have taken about 5 minutes to go through driving the slope of this line to within a factor of two from this quantum zero point motion consideration. This is in this region is where the ice cores are taken in Greenland. Okay, so what is the origin of that of the ice ages, this 100,000 year period? The most likely explanation is variations in the Earth's orbit. So it turns out that the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit varies on timescales of about 100,000 years and 400,000 years due to the gravitational pull mainly of Venus and Jupiter. Venus because it's the closest planet to the Earth, and Jupiter because it's the most massive. There's also the precession of the equinoxes. Right now, the Earth's north pole is pointing close to the star Polaris. But back in the time of the Egyptians, it was pointing towards a star named Alpha Draconis. And so due to the torque exerted by the sun and the moon on the equatorial bulge of the Earth, there are two periods here of 19 and 23,000 years. Finally, the tilt of the Earth's axis, or technically its obliquity, oscillates with a period of about 41,000 years. This is not due to any direct torque that the planets exert on the Earth. In any case, that would just cause precession. But rather, the plane of the Earth's orbit, its ecliptic, oscillates back and forth through the plane of Jupiter, basically. So Jupiter's angular momentum kind of defines the angular momentum of the solar system. And so the Earth is tugged by Jupiter, and so it swings back and forth. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the history of this. This was actually first proposed, some ideas along these lines, in 1864 by a Scottish physicist, James Crowell. And then in the 20s and 30s, a Serbian mathematician, Milankovic, focused in particularly on summer radiation at the high latitudes as the primary cause. So the idea is here that these orbital changes do not influence the total flux of light hitting the Earth significantly, just very slight changes. But they do have a marked impact on the amount of light that reaches the northern latitudes by changing the orientation of the Earth. And so if there's more sunlight reaching the far northern or southern latitudes, that will tend to drive glaciers away. That might be a cause for ending of an ice age. So Milankovic put this on firm mathematical footing. And here are actually some plots of the oscillations of these three things, the eccentricity, the precession of the equinoxes, and the obliquity. This is the past. This is 250,000 years ago. This is the present. And then this is the future. Strong empirical support for this idea came from analysis of ocean sediment cores by John Imbrie, who's a professor emeritus at Brown, and others in the 70s. So let's look at some real power spectra of the climate records. This is, again, a delta 018 plot. This is coming from, actually, ocean sediment cores going back about 800,000 years. So ocean sediment cores, the 018 varies in the opposite direction as the 018 in Antarctica, because when 018 rich water is removed from the ocean and ends up in Antarctica, therefore decreasing 018 in the ocean and increasing it in Antarctica. So we have a negative, high temperature is negative 018 in ocean sediments. So let's Fourier transform this plot. If we Fourier transform this plot, we have a peak at 100,000 years, 41,000 years, 24 and 22,000 years, and 19,000 years. A rather spectacular agreement with the astronomical theory of Milankovitch. Let's look at instead the Vostok ice core. If we look at the Vostok ice core, we'll just look at it now in real time. And here, the solid line is the Vostok 018 that I showed you before, and the dotted line is actually the insulation, that is the solar radiation at 45 degrees north as predicted from celestial mechanics. And you can see that not only does the frequency agree, but the phase agrees with the data. This still leaves a number of open questions. Something must be amplifying these orbital changes to produce the ice ages. Simple climate models would not, even with this type of variation, be able to produce ice ages on their own, but there must be some positive feedback processes. A simple example of such a process is that if the ice grows, it reflects more light and therefore has a net cooling effect, perhaps accelerating the growth of the ice. We should ask, why does the 100,000-year eccentricity period dominate the climate signal? It wasn't obviously a larger effect than the other two. And furthermore, it turns out that about 500,000 years ago, it was the 41,000-year cycle that was of dominant importance. In fact, it's for most of the period during the ice ages, it's been the dominant signal. And you can see that without doing any fancy Fourier transform. You can see that just with your eye. Here's the last 500,000 years, the 100,000-year cycle dominates, and then before, the 41,000-year cycle dominates for some reason. Interestingly, Martian climate shows evidence of orbital forcing of a la Milankovitch. A study of the Martian polar caps trying to reconstruct the climate from changes in the ice at the edges seems to agree with the predictions of orbital mechanics, which in the case of Mars show rather stronger variations than Earth. Earth has actually a stabilizing influence from the Moon, which Mars lacks. And also, of course, Mars is closer to Jupiter than the Earth. Now, from this, we can actually deduce this climate sensitivity. That is the sensitivity of the Earth's climate to a change in, say, carbon dioxide concentration. Because we know that the Earth was about 5 degrees Celsius colder on average during the ice ages. And we also know what the effect of the ice sheets and the changes in vegetation, the decrease in greenhouse gases that we've seen during the ice ages, and also aerosols had on the radiative forcing of the atmosphere. That is, we could repeat the same calculation of the energetics, the energy fluxes of the atmosphere, taking into account these changes in the albedo and the absorptive properties of the gases in the atmosphere, to deduce that a change of radiative forcing of about minus 6.6 watts per meter squared led to a 5-degree cooling. So in other words, we expect about 0.75 degrees Celsius change for every 1 watt per meter squared of forcing. So how much forcing are we currently exerting on the atmosphere? This is relative to 1850, before the Industrial Revolution really affected the Earth's climate. You can see that CO2 by itself affects about 1.4 watts per meter squared. The other greenhouse gases are nearly, when summed up, nearly as important as carbon dioxide. Then we have a soot from pollution, black carbon, which is strongly absorbing. So it's also a net positive forcer in terms of radiation. And we have some negative effects. For example, pollution, aerosols released from smokestacks has a net cooling effect. And in fact, this is the reason why in the 70s, some climate scientists were worried about the possibility that Earth could go into a new ice age. So when we account for all of these things, the net forcing is something around 1.5 watts per meter squared at present. So multiplying by that sensitivity of 0.75 degrees Celsius per 1 watt per meter squared, we get a 1.2 degrees Celsius warming at present. All right, let's look at the recent past. Here is, as promised, the atmospheric carbon dioxide since the Middle Ages, year 81,000. You can see it's basically constant, with perhaps some small decrease associated with the Little Ice Age, but then starts shooting up due to the industrial activities. And you can actually see a point of inflection here due to the Great Depression and World War II affecting production of carbon dioxide. United Nations has tabulated the consumption of carbon in various forms like oil and coal, and you can see the effects of various things like the Vietnam War, and I think this is the energy crisis, and so on. If we look in more detail, this is a plot of carbon dioxide concentration measured by Charles Keeling and collaborators at Mauna Loa, Hawaii and Antarctica since 1957 in the case of Antarctica. Notice we have the beautiful seasonal cycle just reflecting the fact that in the spring, in the northern hemisphere, the plants are growing, absorbing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, so the carbon dioxide level drops, and in the fall they die, giving it back up. Most plants are in the northern hemisphere, where most of the land is. In Antarctica, this oscillation has been smoothed out because it takes some time for parcels of air to work its way down to Antarctica. Now, you might notice back in the 50s, since early 60s, Antarctica is kind of the average of Hawaii. Hawaii is oscillating about the Antarctica value. But now Antarctica is down at the bottom. And that's because the sources of carbon dioxide in the northern hemisphere have grown in rate of production so much that there is a visible flux, a visible gradient of carbon dioxide concentration working its way south over time. Also of interest is the amplitude of the seasonal cycle seems to be growing. Now, you might be able to see here that it isn't perfectly smooth. There's some irregular structure here on this carbon dioxide growth rate. And so back when I was a graduate student and my advisor Ian Affleck left Princeton for UBC and I was left behind for a year to my own devices, I decided to take a look at that. And what we found, to our surprise, is that the carbon dioxide and temperature seems to be correlated rather strongly. Now, this isn't the greenhouse effect, but rather the reverse. There's a kind of positive feedback going on when the Earth fluctuates in temperature from year to year, and when it's warmer, there's more carbon dioxide released probably from natural sources into the atmosphere. For example, if it's warmer, it may be more likely to have a drought, and then the forests will burn, releasing carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. So this is of concern because this is the kind of thing that could exacerbate the effects of global warming. It's not a trivial concern because if we look at the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, it's about 750 gigatons. But the amount of carbon in just soils and vegetation is something like 2,000 gigatons. The amount in the surface ocean is about 1,000 gigatons. The fluxes back and forth between these reservoirs on an annual average are nearly balanced. We have 90 gigatons going into the atmosphere from the ocean and 92 going back. So if climate change occurs, these processes, if they're tampered with, could become slightly out of balance, And because the fluxes are so large compared to the human fluxes of input of about 5.5 gigatons per year, then that could exacerbate the change in the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And as we've seen empirically, it seems to be a positive relationship. All right. Now, back when I first gave this talk here, we didn't have so much information about the recent temperature of the Earth, but a lot of effort has been spent over the past few years trying to reconstruct the climate. And this plot shows the temperature reconstructed in the northern hemisphere, also from 81,000 to near the present. And you can see the average here, the running average, if anything, showed a slight decline, but then it starts to shoot up in the 20th century. This is this cooling that occurred after World War II, from about 1940 to 1960, that got some climate scientists concerned about the possibility of industrial pollutants triggering a new ice age. But as you can see, that ended abruptly. 1998 was the warmest year on record. So there's something qualitatively has changed in the 20th century. Now, I'd like to emphasize how difficult these types of measurements are. Even with actual instruments, this is actually from the Pinnacles National Monument, just 100 miles north of here, details matter a lot. So there's a thermometer inside this standard weather box, but this weather box has to be prescribed in a certain height above the surface, and it has to have a double roof here with a gap, air gap in it. All of these things make a difference when we're talking about measuring temperatures at the level of a tenth of a degree Celsius. So a different way to extract the past temperature, which is rather appealing, is to drill holes into stable rock formations and look at the geothermal profile, the temperature as a function of depth, and then solve the inverse problem of the diffusion of a heat signal from the surface into that rock. So doing that at these locations also seems to show that there is a rather steep rise in the temperature in the 20th century. This is the instrumental record superimposed on top of the reconstruction. And let me just mention, since I'm sometimes asked, in our calculation of the Earth's temperature, we neglected the heat flux coming out of the Earth due to the internal heat of the Earth. That turns out to be negligible if we put in the thermal conductivity of granite, for example, and the observed geothermal gradient of about 0.03 degrees per meter, then this flux is four orders of magnitude smaller than the solar flux. So it's really negligible. Here's the most recent reconstruction, now attempting to look at the entire Earth, not just the northern hemisphere. And you can see, and this is also going back to nearly 2,000 years ago, you can see what's sometimes called the medieval optimum, where the temperatures may have been slightly warmer. These are the results of different extrapolations, so you can see that there's a lot of disagreement, but there seems to be some agreement anyway that the 20th century is anomalously warm and accelerating. This is the most recent instrumental record going up through 2003. 2003 was the second warmest year on record since 1880, exceeded only by 1998. So there are signs of warming all around the world. Glaciers are melting nearly everywhere with only a few exceptions. The sea level is rising by 1 to 2 millimeters per year, due mainly to thermal expansion and the influx of meltwater from the glaciers. Arctic ice is thinning, and the warming is greater over the North Polar region, which is consistent with the greenhouse effect. Here we have some warming, very extreme warming in Alaska and also Northern Asia. This is just for 1 year. Okay, so this is a highly simplified flow chart of a climate model. It's really the most complicated problem I think people have faced attempting to model. The things that I've discussed are all in here, but there are many other things I haven't even mentioned yet, like volcanoes. And attempting to understand this is really an exceedingly difficult problem. I mean, we really wouldn't want to do this except for the fact that it's so crucially important. So let me just talk about some of the uncertainties of the models before showing you some recent results. As I mentioned, there are a vast range of time scales that need to be modeled. Also, there's a huge range of length scales. Pessimistically put, there's 16 orders of magnitude of length scales from the circumference of the Earth to the smallest aerosol particles. The big question is, how will clouds respond to global warming? Will the net effect of water vapor, both in clouds and in the vapor form, be positive or negative? And so it depends on what type of clouds develop. More cumulus clouds have a net cooling effect. More cirrus clouds have a net warming effect because they let light through. A simple argument that we can give in the spirit of this talk is as follows. It turns out that it's an empirical fact that the relative humidity stays roughly constant throughout the year in most locations. For example, in Santa Barbara, it's around 65% summer or winter. So the relative humidity is some crude measure of the probability to form clouds. So in the summertime, the cloudiness is about the same as in the wintertime. Therefore, the clouds are reflecting about as much light either way. On the other hand, in the summertime, the absolute humidity is much higher because there's more water vapor for the same relative humidity. And we've seen that water vapor in a non-condensed form is a very strong greenhouse gas. So this argument suggests positive feedback, an amplifying effect. And although there's a lot of controversy, most observations seem to support this, most empirical observations. There's the question of the role of natural dust, soot, and aerosols. As we've seen, that probably has had an effect. Questions about fluctuations in the solar activity. This affects both directly through the solar constant changing during the solar cycle, and also perhaps indirectly through cosmic rays impinging on the Earth's upper atmosphere, forming nucleation sites for clouds. So here's a plot that's a little bit disturbing that was in Physical Review letters last year, showing a reconstruction of the sunspot number from the present back, back to 850 AD. And so we have observations since the time of Galileo, but we also have various proxy measurements based on carbon-14 that allow the record to extend back. And you notice rather disturbingly, in that same point where the Earth's temperature is spiking, we also have what seems to be increased solar activity. I think this is just coincidence, but it's the sort of thing that has to be kept in mind. All right, let me just say a few more things about the uncertainties of the models. We have the question of interaction between the atmosphere and the oceans, coupling processes with very different time scales, changes in land use that affects the Earth's albedo, future emissions of greenhouse gases, of course we can only project, the potential for some sudden nonlinear response. We know this has happened in the past, that there have been sudden changes in the Earth's climate. Usually these are associated with drastic changes in the ocean circulation. So we could go on, but the upshot is that the simplest kind of model, the spherical Kalm model that we considered here, or the most sophisticated computer models indicate that a doubling of CO2, which will occur sometime this century, relative to the pre-industrial values, will raise the temperature of the Earth by a few degrees centigrade. The official range is 1.4 to 5.8 degrees Celsius. So let's see what that looks like on our plot. This is just to show that there have been very sudden changes in the temperature in the past, as seen from the climate records, and due to changes in the ocean circulation, which transports heat. And my program just crashed. Those are probably localized changes, such as a shutdown of the North Atlantic Current due to an influx of fresh water. The ocean currents are driven by density changes, density differences in the water, and the density is controlled by the salinity and the temperature. Okay. So there's some possible feedback from climate change on the circulation by changing the density of the water.
The change you showed on a historical plot, the one before this, what was the magnitude of the climate change?
In the most recent case, the Younger Dryas event, which is when we were coming out of the last ice age, Northern Europe was suddenly thrust back into the ice age. So that would have been 5 or 10 degrees Celsius change for at least for Northern Europe. There's some question about how widespread that temperature change was, but that's presumably due to the shutdown of basically the Gulf Stream. So that was a large effect. I think all of those fluctuations are pretty large. All right, so before we look at the most recent models, I'd like to show you a plot that I really like that Jim Hansen did. This is based on a model he actually carried out in 1988, so it's by far it's far from the most sophisticated models that are now done, 15 years later. But what he's done is he's gone back, here are his predictions, and he's added in data points for what actually happened. So the red line is the actual temperature of the Earth, and these data points are subsequent came after his model. And you can see that perhaps the climate signal is beginning to emerge from the noise. The global warming is beginning to emerge from the noise. These are three different scenarios for projections on the human contribution to carbon dioxide. Now, in his model, he had a simulated volcano here, and nature actually obliged him by the eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the early 1990s, which threw up a lot of dust, having a temporary cooling effect on the Earth's atmosphere. And the model tends to capture these things. You can see a volcano, it throws up a lot of material. This is in Mount Pinatubo, this is in Alaska, the same sort of thing, going into the stratosphere, and it takes a couple years for this stuff to rain out. And if we look at radiative forcings over time, then we have the greenhouse gases steadily increasing, but they're interrupted every so often by eruptions such as Mount Pinatubo that has a net cooling effect. Now, this person, Richardson, is truly a person ahead of his time. He envisioned a human weather computer. And he was actually an ambulance driver during World War I. He's a physicist. And during his spare time, he attempted to integrate the basic equations of motion for the Earth's atmosphere by hand while sitting in a barn on top of some hay somewhere. But he envisioned eventually building a so-called forecast factory that would have 64,000 human computers in it. And you can see these are stands of human beings, each one is assigned to some region of the Earth. And there's a director here who's shining his light over on this region. Evidently, somebody has fallen behind. And hopefully, fresh replacements are being sent. So all right, let's look at the modern predictions. This is the Northern Hemisphere historic temperature record, the one that we saw a few minutes ago. And this is the predictions for the next 100 years. So as you can see, we seem to be emerging from the noise. And in any case, if you don't think we have now, just wait another decade or so. So big problems are likely, but and the skeptics of global warming have changed their tune recently. Most of them now are conceding that global warming will occur. But now they are saying that this will make for a better world. This comes from the Providence Journal, my hometown paper, which is a Republican newspaper, which basically any such point of view is voiced there. So I get a steady stream of this. So this ignores a number of things. One is the rise in sea level. This is for Newport, Rhode Island. By the end of this century, it could be somewhere between half a meter and a meter. That will have a big impact on coastal land. It's thought that by the end of the century, about 5% of Florida will be underwater. We could expect that the magnitude and frequency of hurricanes will increase because there will be more water vapor in the Earth's atmosphere, and that's the driving energy source for hurricanes. Tropical insects that spread disease like malaria can be expected to expand as the frost-free regions of the Earth also expand due to global warming. The frequency and severity of heat waves would certainly be expected to increase. This is from last summer. It was 45 degrees Celsius in the center of India for an extended period, killing something like 800 people. Turning to non-human life form, the polar bears require ice, Arctic ice, in order to go out and hunt seals. Coral reefs are dying all around the world, partly due to increased water temperature, but also other stresses due to human activities, pollution. We have the possibility of increased burning of forests. As I mentioned, that's a positive feedback process. And also, infections seem to be spreading into regions where they haven't been before. Large swaths of Alaskan forest are being killed by beetles. Okay, so I have just a minute or two. I'd just like to say a few things about this so-called quantum field theory of global warming. So what am I talking about? So we know that to study the properties of a gas, it would be crazy to integrate the equations of motion for a mole of molecules in order to deduce the ideal gas law. So instead, we developed statistical physics to do that. Likewise, climate is statistical, but weather is not. So to model climate, it seems wasteful to compute averages by integrating the equations of motion forward in time for long periods. So the question I want to ask is, can we develop purely statistical methods to extract climate statistics like the average temperature for models? And so there's a variety of techniques that allow us to do such things in principle. And basically, they involve the construction of linear Schrodinger-like equations that govern probability distribution functions. So I'm going to illustrate for you some preliminary results in a moment. But let me just point out that you can actually go to the web and download a climate model from this site. It currently just runs on PCs, but it's going to be ported to Macs and Unix machines soon. And this is basically everybody has a different initial condition. And you integrate this on your computer for a couple months and then send the results back. And then averages are computed. So that's what I'd like to avoid having to do. So actually, Edward Lorenz pointed out back in the 60s that a statistical approach might make sense. He said that more than any theoretical procedure, numerical integration is also subject to the criticism that it yields little insight into the problem. The computed numbers are not only processed like data, but they look like data. And a study of them may be no more enlightening than a study of real meteorological observations. An alternative procedure which does not suffer this disadvantage consists in deriving a new system of equations whose unknowns are the statistics themselves. So I'd like to illustrate what we've been attempting to do. So first I'll begin with a little toy model, which is the well-known Lorentz attractor. It's a set of three coupled differential equations, nonlinear equations. We have, for example, x times y here. And as is well known, if we integrate this equation in time, we find this unusual structure. And so let me do a little simulation for you of that. So we let this run. We go winding around. No matter what our initial condition is, we get drawn into this attractor. And down here, I'm computing the average values of x, y, and z. The z direction is suppressed, and also the second moments. And so, for example, average value of x and y are tending to 0, and z is approaching about 22.7. And the average value of z squared minus z quantity squared is about 44 or so. We start from some other initial condition, then we just have to wait a little while, and we'll get the same statistics. So this is like different initial conditions in a weather model. We're trying to get the average values out, but we don't really care about the details here. We only want to wait long enough so that the averages settle down. So can we calculate those numbers more directly? And the answer is yes. So as I mentioned, here's the average value of x and y. Turns out to be exactly 0 by symmetry, z 22.7, and z squared is about 44. So please remember that for a moment. Uh, All right, so the approach I'm going to take is something called the log-Hopf equation, and I'll illustrate it just with this very simple equation of motion, which could be easily generalized to the Lorentz equation. Here we have x dot equals x squared. Now, of course, that's not really a stable equation, but it will serve to illustrate the method. We introduce something that looks a lot like a wave function. Psi of t and u is equal to e to the I u times x of t. So u is kind of a conjugate variable to x. Now, if we take a time derivative of psi and two derivatives of psi with respect to u, well, the time derivative of psi brings down an x dot, and the two derivatives with respect to u bring down an x squared. We multiply by u and an I, then we just recover this equation. But the advantage of doing this is that, like any good Schrodinger equation, this is linear. So now we can average over the initial conditions. We can average on both sides of that equation, and the average of psi also obeys the same equation. So we're going to average over the initial conditions. Now we just have to solve that Schrodinger equation by whatever our favorite method is. So I'm going to take a variational ansatz. I'm going to write it's e to the s, where s is basically a Taylor series expansion in cumulants. We plug that in and do it for a three-dimensional model instead of a one-dimensional model for the Schrodinger equation, for the Lorentz model. Then working to third order, we get 23.37 instead of 22.7, and this is about 40 instead of 44. So there's some qualitative agreement here in this type of calculation. So let's now try to apply this to a field theory. So instead of looking at this simple low-dimensional Lorentz attractor, we want to look at field variables such as the vorticity, the curl of the velocity. So this model that I want to illustrate now is actually the simplest general circulation model of the Earth's atmosphere. It's the one that von Neumann chose to study in his pioneering computer models of the Earth's atmosphere back in the 50s. What we're doing is we're integrating the inviscid Navier-Stokes equation for two-dimensional flow on a rotating Earth. So we have a Coriolis force, which is causing this net rotation. The red color is positive vorticity. Vorticity is the curl of the wind velocity. And blue, of course, is negative. So integrate this forward in time, and this computer, which, by the way, is carrying out more calculations than Richardson's human computer of 64,000 human beings could ever do. If we look at the mean values, then as expected, we're recovering the azimuthal symmetry of the Earth, since the Earth is rotating about this axis, but on average, the observables will be axially symmetric. We can calculate the cumulants, and looking at correlations between different points, and so on. So let's see how well this agrees with the actual the Hopf equation. So this is a result for the vorticity of our rotating Earth. This is coming from a cumulant expansion, coming from our Schrodinger-like Hopf equation. And then there's some very recent actual observations of the vorticity of the Earth's atmosphere coming from a four-year mean calculated by or observed by satellites looking at the stress that wind exerts on the ocean surface. And you can see clearly these bands of negative, positive, negative, and positive vorticity emerging just due to the circulation of the Earth's atmosphere and the rotating coordinate system. So there's some evidence that this approach may be fruitful. And what we'd like to do now is to, as usual, develop some non-perturbative approaches going beyond a cumulant expansion. So what's the value of one more study? This talk has emphasized, perhaps too much, the average temperature of the Earth. But what we really need to know is more specific predictions of what's going to happen in the coming century, which regions will dry out, which regions will get hotter, which regions might get colder, and so on. And that level of prediction still eludes models. People make these predictions, but they're not really believable. So let me end with this quote. This comes from 1957. Some oceanographers from Scripps noticed that human beings are now carrying out a large-scale geophysical experiment of a kind that could not have happened in the past nor be reproduced in the future. Within a few centuries, we were returning to the atmosphere and oceans the concentrated organic carbon stored in sedimentary rocks over hundreds of millions of years. Thank you. Apparently. Yeah, it's my expectation that it's a coincidence, but one should keep an open mind about this. But yes, you might have noticed back here, when we're looking at the forcing relative to 1850, there was a positive contribution due to the sun. So this is trying to include the increased solar activity. So it's known that the sun fluctuates in brightness, but by quite small amounts over the past couple decades, only by 0.1%. And so this is small compared to these things, but it has been included. And some of the modelers have argued that one cannot get a good agreement with the actual climate of the 20th century without including both this, the aerosols, and the carbon dioxide. Now, whether that is believable, that conclusion is believable or not, I think remains to be seen. But people have certainly attempted to include that effect.
What is forced cloud changing?
This would be a secondary effect due to global warming. The clouds are responding, and so unlike my simplest model, they presumably are. There are probably somewhat more clouds. Having some net cooling effect. Yes. Oh, well, so it's well known that it's very difficult to calculate the weather more than a few weeks in advance. We all know that. And based on sort of general arguments, knowing that the atmosphere is such a nonlinear system, then if we started from some slightly different initial condition, then we get some wildly different final weather, 2 weeks down the road. So on the other hand, there's the hope that climate, looking at long-term averages over decades, may be a more stable thing. Now, we don't have any proof of it. There's no ergodicity theorem or, that this is the case. But certainly this is an assumption that's made not only in my approach, but even in just what's done today in terms of integrating these essentially sophisticated weather models forward in time and then calculating averages. So now, it might be that if you could actually integrate one of these weather models for 10,000 years, you'd find that it's still, the climate is fluctuating over all time scales. And so there's many open questions of that kind. But it's generally believed that these things settle down into some sort of steady state behavior. They're fluctuating, but if you calculate averages, 10-year average 100 years from now and then 200 years from now, holding everything else the same, the carbon dioxide concentration, you would get the same answer. It depends on where you are. So in general, there'll be more moisture in the atmosphere. There's some places that are predicted to be wetter, and some places might be drier. So it's very getting to more detailed predictions like that. I think in general, the global hydrological cycle will accelerate. There will be more water in the system on average. But in terms of dryness, soil moisture, that's very complicated because that includes both the effects of temperature and the input of moisture. So predictions of that type are much more difficult.
Phil? Given even if you shut off the tap and stop producing excess CO2 and other greenhouse gases, we'd still be in for a significant change, it looks like.
Right.
Has there been any serious discussion on intentional changes that we could make that would in fact negate that or modify that or, you know,
yeah,
global engineering, human, or completely mess it up. Yeah, I don't know.
Right. Yeah, you raise an important point, which is that there's a thermal inertia due to the heat capacity of the oceans, which I haven't mentioned. So that even if we could stabilize the carbon dioxide concentration at the present value, the Earth will still continue to warm somewhat. That's why the temperature increase hasn't reached this 1.2 degrees Celsius from our simple prediction. So there's still several decades of warming, even if the atmosphere were kept unperturbed. Or no further perturbations. But then, so regarding attempting to directly ameliorate this effect, there have been a number of suggestions. For example, it's known that the oceans absorb carbon dioxide partly through the uptake by cyanobacteria that are photosynthesizing the carbon dioxide. And so if you could enhance their growth, you might be able to absorb more carbon dioxide. And in most of the oceans, plankton is limited by the lack of certain minerals like iron. So it's been suggested that one could fertilize the oceans with iron to try to enhance the growth of these things, and then they might absorb more carbon dioxide and sink. But there are many problems with that suggestion, and it's not clear that that would actually work. In addition, you would certainly be modifying the environment in some drastic way, so there might be some ugly surprise at the end. But small-scale experiments have been conducted, and the results have not been so promising. For example, these things tend to die in the surface waters, and then they just release their carbon dioxide back out to the air instead of bringing it down to depth. So that's one suggestion. Now, another maybe less drastic approach would be to identify what are the most cost-effective solutions to reducing the forcing. And Jim Hansen has taken this point of view that you notice that these other greenhouse forcings, especially black carbon, but also methane and so on, are making a significant contribution. Now, carbon dioxide is very tough to reduce because it's so intimately connected with our energy production. But a lot of this methane could be reduced. It's coming partly from releases from gas pipelines and from agriculture. And black carbon we'd like to reduce anyway because it's basically coming from combustion of organic matter in the third world and diesel fuel. Soot. We'd like to get rid of the soot. So there'd be many reasons to try to reduce these things, those might be more cost-effective than directly focusing on carbon dioxide. Although in the long term, this is really the nut that has to be cracked, because carbon dioxide production is, if anything, is likely to continue to increase.
But is planet-scale engineering in terms of introducing reflective aerosols in the atmosphere, things like that, is there any serious discussion of things like that? I mean, you can imagine just having massive nuclear war would help reduce the temperature.
Right.
It also solves some other problems, too.
I think these are the kinds of things that are discussed informally, but I haven't seen anything in print.
I'm an on-the-ground ecologist, so dealing with this issue with the folks in the various agencies and all that is a constant problem. And I know you ran out of time to deal with it, but just really quickly, can you touch on how do you try and explain to these folks that, yeah, there's a lot of variation in predictions, but we're in deep, deep duty. How do you kind of get out of that quagmire? Because even myself listening to this as a biologist, I'm going, you didn't need it when it comes to all the physics stuff. So how do you get through that?
Darn if I know.
It'll be funny.
There'll be nothing left by then, though.
Yeah, I think basic problem is that human beings are very bad at responding to things that have long time scales, and they respond to crises. So one approach would be to wait until the crises get sufficiently bad, but I don't think that's the optimal choice. So I could say a few words about a lot of the misleading information that's out there, which I think is confusing to policymakers, but maybe I'll save that for a private discussion.
There's a question over there. It's kind of a follow-up to that. Scientific community, physicists, chemists, ecologists, it seems pretty clear to us that the risks are huge and that policy has been drummed out of credibility.
Right.
And why do we stand for that? why do we put up with that as scientists?
Yeah, that's a good question. And perhaps I'll show just one slide, which I think illustrates some of the problem that we face. Right. It's a good question. Let's see. Oh, yeah, okay.
I wonder if people here can stand up and say, enough is enough. And the person ought to ask herself that question.
Well, let me just illustrate one rather disturbing episode. So I showed you this plot, which Jim Hansen produced, and he did the what I think is the scientifically admirable thing, going back and checking how well his prediction made in 1988 stood up to time. And we could now add a few more points here. We'd be out here in this temperature range now. So Hansen and Pat Michaels, he was the one that I showed you the article arguing that global warming is good for us, were asked to testify in Congress. So let me read what Jim Hansen said about that. But when Pat Michaels testified to Congress in 1998 and showed our 1988 predictions, this figure, he erased the curves for scenarios B and C. These were the less extreme scenarios that actually turned out to be closer to the carbon dioxide production that people actually produced. Erased those two scenarios and showed only the more extreme scenario A. He then argued that since the real world temperature had not increased as fast as this model calculation, the climate model was faulty, and there was no basis for concern about climate change, specifically concluding that the Kyoto Protocol was a useless appendage to an irrelevant treaty. Now, Pat Michaels is a PhD scientist, a climatologist, and I think we can all agree that that kind of monkeying around with somebody else's results is not really the sort of thing that is helpful in science. So, but there's been a lot of that going on, and that certainly has caused a lot of confusion.
Who does he work for?
He is, I believe, at the University of Virginia. I'm not sure.
Did you explain why the previous stages went from 31,000 to
5,000? I didn't attempt to explain that. There are some ideas, but that's an active area of research. It's not really my area of research. But let me give you one suggestion that's been made. And that is back half a million years ago, the carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere were somewhat lower than they were in the pre-industrial past. That is, they're lower than the 280 parts per million. So they were a little bit higher. So the Earth was a little bit harder for the Earth to enter into. They were a little bit lower. So the Earth was a little bit easier for the Earth to get into an ice age. So this higher frequency perturbation may have been the Earth may have been able to respond to it, but as you can see, my understanding is rather fragmentary.
Perhaps one more question.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
How does CO2 absorb? It has no.